Alright, so that's it. That's been our show. It's been 8 Miles High with Nick and Andy every Tuesday, 9 to 11 p.m.
Thank you for listening. Thanks for calling to our callers, tonight's callers. Special thank you and shout out and accolades to Tom from Overbrook and Ruth Ann from New Kensington. It wasn't that scary, was it, guys, calling in? It's not that scary, people. You can handle it. So, special thank you to them.
Yes. All right. We'll see you next week. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
The years you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've tuned in to Pandemonium, a public affairs anthology from WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed on this show are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs, pa@wrct.org. And now, Pandemonium.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. It's time for another edition of Pandemonium here. It's been a pretty new show. It's going for a few weeks now. Basically, DJs just do whatever they want to do. My name's Bill. I normally do a heavy metal show on Sunday nights called To Evil of a Human Name, but I'm also very interested in bagpiping. I've been playing myself for a few years. And CMU obviously has a big history of piping. And today on our episode, I have Andrew Carlisle, who's the director of piping here. He's going to talk a little bit about himself and his position and CMU and play a few tunes for us. Welcome to the show, Andy. How long have you been here at CMU for?
Oh, hello, Bill. Yeah, I've been in Pittsburgh at Carnegie Mellon now for almost 12 years, just coming up to the end of the 12th year yet.
Yeah, and how did that all happen? Where did you start out and how did you end up here?
Oh, I'm originally from a small village in Northern Ireland called Ballygowan. And when I was 7 years old, I took up the instrument, the bagpipe. And yeah, just kind of took it from there. Ended up, you know, studying with some of the great players in both Ireland and Scotland. And then played with some various bands across the water. And then I was kind of finishing up grad school, and the job at Carnegie Mellon was posted, so I just applied for it, and here I am, I guess, 12 years later, yeah. So 2010 is when I started.
All right, and it's now 2022. You've been obviously enjoying your time here. You really enjoy the piping program here at CMU. You think it's up there with other places in the world?
Yeah, for sure. Well, it was actually the first in the world to offer a degree in piping and also the first to offer a master's. And yeah, it's a terrific institution here. We've got a really good program and a really good student body. The degree program is actually quite small, being that you have to be a very high standard to be admitted to it. But we also have a lot of non-music majors that play the pipes, that come for lessons and play in the band. And we also have the opportunity for first-year students to, you know, just learn the instrument from scratch. You know, so I do a lot of teaching beginners as well here.
And do you get a lot of those kind of students that seem to really, you know, stick with it? Or do you get a lot of people that just come in and the oddity of it, maybe, since you don't have as much piping as back home?
I mean, usually, I mean, with any musical instrument, there's quite a big commitment as to, like, learning it and, you know, sticking with it and practicing. And sometimes you do get some people that get excited by it, but, you know, when they start their academic studies in computer science or biology or whatever it may be, it gets a bit too much and they give it up. But the vast majority do stick with it. I would say there's at least maybe an 80% retention rate from people who start out to, you know, versus people that, you know, don't stick with it, kind of thing, on the beginner front. Yeah. And I get students from all over the world. You know, I've had them from pretty much every continent, aside from Antarctica, I guess, yeah.
Maybe someday. And obviously there's the CMU band, which is pretty active, doing a lot of different events. You'll be doing the graduation ceremony soon.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, we've got a pretty good pipe band here. It's, I mean, the last time the American Pipe Band Championships were held in 2019, pre-pandemic, Carnegie Mellon won, so a pretty high standard of pipe band. And yeah, it's very active in the greater Pittsburgh community. We just finished up a series of five concerts with River City Brass Band, a series called Celtic Connections. We'll be playing at Commencement. We just played a couple of weeks ago at CMU's Spring Carnival. We're at the St. Patrick's Day Parade downtown in Pittsburgh. So, yeah, we're pretty active in the community as well.
And then you're also involved with the Pittsburgh Piping Society here, which is something that you and a few other pipers started a few years ago. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's probably about 7 or 8 years ago now that we started it. So, basically, there were a lot of bagpipers in Pittsburgh, and a lot of them seemed to live in apartments or condos and things like that that they'd couldn't practice, or they didn't have very many opportunities that they could go and either play with other pipers or play in front of other pipers. So we kind of just formed this as a kind of social club, and basically the format is it's kind of like an open mic night for bagpipers. So if you want to come and have a tune in front of a supportive, friendly environment, you know, it's a perfect place for people to come along. And we've had it in various different venues throughout the city over the years. But, yeah, the average kind of crowd we usually get is about 60 people, I think.
And it's based on some earlier piping societies, correct, including one here in the Pittsburgh area?
That's right, yeah. Unknown to me, there was a Pittsburgh Bagpipe Society, PBS. I'm not sure if they copyrighted the initials or not back then, but... Yeah, in the late 1800s, there was a Pittsburgh Bagpiping Society. I don't know too much about it, but I've seen records that it definitely existed. It must have kind of, you know, stopped existing at some point in the early 1900s. But yeah, thankfully in the kind of 2000s, I guess, we resurrected it. Yeah, and yeah, it's pretty thriving. We just had an evening there last Friday evening in Squirrel Hill, and with a very good turnout, and with at least maybe a dozen pipers that played in that evening. Yeah.
If there's anyone listening right now that's not really knowledgeable at bagpiping or anything like that, where should they check? Just check the website for that kind of stuff?
Yeah, Pittsburgh Piping Society. We have a Facebook page, and I believe the website's currently under construction, but yeah, we do have a website. But yeah, the Facebook page is pretty active as to like when the next gathering or meeting or performance is going to be.
All right, great. Well, let's get into some music. You mind playing a few tunes for us?
Yeah, sure.
Up first, you're going to play Mark Strassbay and Real. You want to tell us a little bit about those tunes real quick before
sure.
you go?
Sure. Well, a march just being real. So first of all, it's a march. So quite from the Scottish military tradition. And the piece, the march I'm going to play is The Braes of Castle Grant. The first two parts of it are traditional, and the third and fourth parts were added by a great piper called George Stuart MacLennan. Ustra Spey is a type of Highland dance. The Highland Fling is the dance that goes to the Ustra Spey, and the Ustra Spey I'm going to play is called Inverary Castle. And the reel is a traditional reel, just a different type of Scottish dance, a Scottish reel. And the reel is entitled The Rejected Suitor.
All right, great. Well, let's get right into it. All right, Andy, that was great. What do you got next? Hopefully it's something maybe, you know, a little faster, a little more party atmosphere.
Sure. Well, how about a hornpipe and jig?
Yeah, that's perfect.
Yeah, so I'll try a hornpipe and jig, which is, yeah, two of the more lively dances in the Scottish repertoire. The hornpipe's called Jim Tweedy Sea Legs, and it was composed by a New Zealander called John Allan McGee.
That sounds like a very New Zealand type name.
I guess. Well, it's got five parts in it, and apparently it's each of the parts are to represent one of the seas that he had to cross to get to Scotland. And then the jig is a composition by pipe major Donald MacLeod, and it's called Donald Cameron's Powder Horn.
All right, perfect. You've been listening to WRCT. We're coming to the end of this episode of Pandemonium. I've been here speaking and listening to Andrew Carlisle, director of piping here at CMU, and he's got one more piece of music to play, a pibroch, some classical bagpipe music. Do you want to tell us a little bit about this final piece you're going to be doing?
Sure. Well, a pibroch is kind of the classical music for the Great Highland Bagpipe, and it was composed in the Highlands and Islands of Scotland. It can be traced back to the 1500s, and it kind of originated on the west coast of the Isle of Skye in a place called Borag by the MacCrimmon family. And so these are very old pieces of music, and it basically consists of a theme, like a melody, and then there's subsequent variations on that melody as you go through the piece. And as you go through the piece, the variations get more technically complex. But they're all based off the original theme. And the piece that I'm going to play is quite a rhythmic piece. It's called The Red Speckled Bull. Now, there's a couple of different stories behind the name. The first is, it's thought to have perhaps been a mistranslation in the Scottish Gaelic, and it was actually supposed to be the Red Speckled Army. So basically the English redcoats, you know, that they're the Scottish clansmen were witnessing at the time. And the other story about the tune is that, well, bagpipe bags are made of leather, and apparently one of the McCrimmons wrestled a bull and killed the bull and skinned the bull and made his pipe bag out of the skin.
Not sure which story is more brutal.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, this is a long piece, so sit back and relax. You've been listening to show Pandemonium. This tune's going to finish off the set, so enjoy and have a good rest of the evening. Thank you, Andy.
You've been listening to Pandemonium. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs, pa@wrct.org. Thanks for listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take a deep dive into two recent Supreme Court oral arguments that have profound implications for the First Amendment in the Internet age.
Our guest, Attorney Zach Wolf, will make a prediction on what he thinks the right-wing Supreme Court will do.
We'll also speak with award-winning author Robin Anderson about U.S.-Israel media genocide complicity.
There's no one in the country more knowledgeable than Robin Anderson. She's from Fair and Activist in the Media and Project Censored, and she'll give us her idea of what's going on with the media.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Last month, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments about two state laws that would regulate how large tech companies control what content can appear on their sites. Republican legislators in Florida and Texas aim to address what they claim are efforts to stifle conservative voices on platforms like Facebook and YouTube. In part, these laws came about after platforms banned Donald Trump for violating their rules against inciting violence in his posts related to the January 6, 2021 Capitol insurrection. The laws would compel companies to carry all users' viewpoints. It would also preclude them from deplatforming political candidates. The Florida law at issue in Moody v. NetChoice and its Texas counterpoint, NetChoice v. Paxton, represent challenges by technology lobbying groups, NetChoice and the Computer and Communications Information Association. The plaintiffs claim the laws violate their First Amendment rights to make editorial choices about what content to permit or to prohibit. They say it will be virtually impossible to monitor and prevent hate speech, pro-terrorism advocacy, and content that could harm children. Joining us today to share his reactions to the oral arguments is professor, author, and attorney Zachary Wolf. Zach, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me back.
Zach, we're going to begin with the opening statement of Henry Whitaker, the Solicitor General of Florida in Moody v. NetChoice. It's just under 5 minutes. Let's take a listen.
Moody versus NetChoice. Mr. Whitaker?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Internet platforms today control the way millions of Americans communicate with each other and with the world. The platforms achieved that success by marketing themselves as neutral forums for free speech. Now that they host the communications of billions of users, they sing a very different tune. They now say that they are in fact editors of their user speech, rather like a newspaper. They contend that they possess a broad First Amendment right to censor anything they host on their sites, even when doing so contradicts their own representations to consumers. But the design of the First Amendment is to prevent the suppression of speech, not to enable it. That is why the telephone company and the delivery service have no First Amendment right to use their services as a choke point to silence those they disfavor. Broadly facilitating communication in that way is conduct, not speech. And if Verizon asserted a First Amendment right to cancel disfavored subscribers at a whim, that claim would fail, no less than the claimed right to censorship failed in Prunard versus Robbins and Rumsfeld versus Fair. Social networking companies, too, are in the business of transmitting their users' speech. Their users are the ones who create and select the content that appears on their sites. The platforms indeed disavow responsibility for that conduct in their terms of service. The platforms do sort and facilitate the presentation of user speech. But this court, just last term in Twitter versus Tamina, and the platforms themselves in Gonzalez versus Google, described those tools as little more than passive mechanisms for organizing vast amounts of third-party content. The platforms do not have a First Amendment right to apply their censorship policies in an inconsistent manner and to censor and deplatform certain users. I welcome your questions.
Counsel, it would seem that this case is a facial challenge. And to some extent, it relies on the overbreath doctrine. But that seems to be an odd fit, since respondent represents virtually all of the platforms, and that it would be easy enough for a platform who's affected to bring it as applied challenge. Would you comment on that? Or at least address the fact that this is a facial challenge.
Certainly, Your Honor, I do think that's a very significant aspect of this case. It comes to the court on a facial challenge, which means that the only question before the court is whether the statute has a plainly legitimate sweep. I actually don't understand them, Your Honor, to be making an overbreadth challenge, which, as I understand it, would rely on the effects on third parties. As I understand it, they're principally relying on the effects on their members. If they were bringing an overbreadth challenge, they would have to show various third-party
statements. Well, I think, how would they do that when they haven't shown that there's no way that this statute can be applied that's consistent with the Constitution? Have they met that?
They certainly have not, Your Honor. I mean, and we think that the statute has indeed a plainly legitimate sweep. And certainly, there are a number of the platforms that are open to all comers and content, much like a traditional common carrier. And just as a traditional common carrier, consistent with the First Amendment, would be subject to hosting requirements, non-discrimination requirements, So too, we think that the platforms that satisfy that characterization, which are a number of them, absolutely would give this statute a plainly legitimate sweep.
This is such an odd case for our usual jurisprudence. It seems like your law is covering just about every social media platform on the internet. And we have amici who are not traditional social media platforms, like smartphones and others who have submitted amici brief, telling them that readings of this law could cover them. This is so broad. It's covering almost everything. But the one thing I know about the internet is that its variety is infinite.
That was Henry Whitaker in his opening arguments. Zach, both bills are overbroad in nature. They seek to restrict social media companies' ability to moderate content, particularly political speech. And that could result in far-reaching consequences beyond their intended scope. One problem being ambiguity of language. The Texas bill prohibits platforms from restricting users based on their, quote, political viewpoint, a term that could encompass a wide range of opinions. This vagueness raises the risk of arbitrary enforcement and legal challenges. By compelling platforms to adhere to specific moderation policies or to face penalties, both laws could undermine the legal framework that has enabled the flourishing of our internet. What do you say to that?
Absolutely. And it's not just that these laws are vague and overbroad, although they certainly are, but they're directed at activity that is just not the most pressing threat to the ability to have digital spaces and platforms that serve a democratic purpose, facilitate the sort of speech and expression that we need. It's basically cliche to say that social media addiction and its near displacement of traditional media has led to serious problems, misinformation leading to election denial and rioting, children engaging in self-harm, so many people facing hate speech and harassment. I believe we need to address that, but those serious problems aren't stemming from too much removal of harmful content. In other words, the Texas and Florida laws are not the sorts of reforms that we need. And despite the problems with these platforms, people stick with them because there's still hope that they can be valuable to us. You know, whether it's expression of a political view or need to reach out for a connection, social media is where we spend a great deal of our time. We can think about social media companies as sort of venue providers for our modern salons. The public needs to be able to secure a venue from a provider who is not obligated to escort in guests who are going to insist that school shootings are hoaxes. Even if that individual makes a living as a journalist or if the state might consider that a viewpoint. It's important to remember that we're not talking about the state criminalizing speech. We're talking about whether it will be possible to engage in the kind of online activity that's become so much a part of people's lives without having to constantly confront posts claiming that your murdered child was a crisis actor and the school shooting was a hoax. And I'm using this particular example in the context of thinking about overbreadth because the Florida law, which in some ways appears to be more tailored, specifies, this is a quote, a social media platform may not take any action to censor, deplatform, or shadow ban a journalistic enterprise based on the content of its publication or broadcast. So this would appear to cover people in companies like Alex Jones and InfoWars, and the Texas law is even broader. It covers all viewpoint discrimination, which means that if a site wants to host content taking the position that school shootings are a major social problem, then it would not be able to discriminate against posts claiming that school shootings are hoaxes. And again, such claims might be constitutionally protected from state censorship, but that doesn't mean that it should not be possible for people to engage with each other over social media platforms without having those kinds of posts fed to us in the same way we get the posts that we want and need to engage with.
Now, Zach, after Henry Whitaker's opening statement, the court heard from Paul D. Clement, the former Solicitor General of the United States from June 2005 till June 2008. He's now an appellate lawyer. Let's hear what Paul had to say.
Mr. Clement?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Florida's effort to level the playing field and to fight the perceived bias of big tech violates the First Amendment several times over. It interferes with editorial discretion. It compels speech. It discriminates on the basis of content, speaker, and viewpoint. And it does all this in the name of promoting free speech, but loses sight of the first principle of the First Amendment, which is it only applies to state action. Florida defends its law, as you've heard this morning, principally by insisting that there's no expressive activity being regulated. That blinks reality. This statute defines the targeted websites in part by how big their audience is. It regulates the content and display of particular websites, and it tries to prevent my clients from censoring speakers and content. If you are telling the websites that you are that they can't censor speakers, you can't turn around and say you're not regulating expressive activity. It's all over this law. And that brings it squarely within the teaching of Tornillo, PG&E, and Hurley. All three of those cases teach that you cannot have the forced dissemination of third-party speech, and they reject considerations of market power, misattribution, or space constraints. And Reno and 303 Creative make clear those principles are fully applicable on the Internet. Indeed, given the vast amount of material on the Internet in general and on these websites in particular, exercising editorial discretion is absolutely necessary to make the websites useful for users and advertisers. And the closer you look at Florida's law, the more problematic the First Amendment problems become. It singles out particular websites in plain violation of Minneapolis Star. Its provisions that give preferences to political candidates and to journalistic enterprises are content-based in the extreme. I welcome the court's questions.
So, Zach, let's discuss the argument that Florida law interferes with editorial discretion, compels speech, and discriminates on the basis of content, speaker, and viewpoint. One issue is the extent to which platforms curate speech and free expression by the users. And for that, we know they enjoy broad First Amendment protection. But many sites also provide services, such as messaging, that do not require editorial supervision. These services, the justices are seeming to suggest, are akin to telephone or internet providers, and therefore can be subject to more government regulation. What's your take on that?
So in the clip that we just heard, the fact that they invoked Hurley and the 303 Creative cases is really important and I think quite telling here. In Hurley, Massachusetts wanted to apply its public accommodations laws to the organizers of the St. Patrick's Day parade, and it would require them to allow a gay organization to march with its banner. The Supreme Court said no, that even though this was a major public event using city streets and it allowed participation from a wide variety of marchers, still the parade organizers had a right to control who could march. And then more recently, 303 Creative said that a website designer could not be compelled to design websites for same-sex marriages despite Colorado's anti-discrimination law. And people are probably thinking of other examples of conservatives invoking the First Amendment to prevent the state from compelling them to provide services to historically discriminated against groups. Hobby Lobby rejected the requirement that employer provided health insurance has to include coverage of birth control. Maybe a little less familiar is National Institute of Family and Life Advocates versus Becerra, which held that a state cannot compel businesses who are offering so-called crisis pregnancy counseling to also make available accurate information regarding the availability of abortion services. So if the Supreme Court now says, despite all of that, the state may compel a social media company to allow in election deniers on their platform, it will serve to further this perception that the court is an ideological body that's not concerned with analytical consistency. Essentially, a business's ability to control its message or not, but it has editorial discretion, or rather can be compelled to allow speech from disruptive and bigoted actors, is going to correspond with whether or not that message is one that will be liked by conservatives or progressives.
Yes, thank you for reminding us of those previous cases, Zach. hopefully some good may come out of that history. Turning back to the SCOTUS arguments, appellate lawyer Paul Clement went on to give the opening argument in Net Choice versus Paxton. Let's take a listen to that.
We will hear argument next in case 22555, Net Choice versus Paxton. Mr. Clement.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I don't want to proceed as if I wasn't here for the first argument, so let me focus on what's different about Texas. One thing, fortunately, that's different about Texas is its definition of social media platforms excludes websites. So we can just put that Gmail issue to one side for when we're talking about Texas. The other thing it excludes, of course, is websites that are primarily focused on news, sports, and entertainment. In the First Amendment business, we call that content-based discrimination. And that's just one of the many reasons that this statute is, dare I say it, facially unconstitutional. The other thing that's different is, in some respects, this statute operates more simply because it forbids my clients from engaging in viewpoint discrimination. Now, we're used to thinking that viewpoint discrimination is a bad thing and that government shouldn't do it. And, of course, when governments do it, it is a bad thing. But when editors or speakers engage in viewpoint discrimination, that is their First Amendment right. It is also absolutely vital to the operation of these websites, because if you have to be viewpoint neutral, that means that if you have materials that are involved in suicide prevention, you also have to have materials that advocate suicide promotion. Or if you have materials on your site that are pro-Semitic, then you have to let on materials onto your site that are anti-Semitic. And that is a formula for making these websites very unpopular to both users and advertisers. So it is absolutely vital. The other thing that makes Texas a little different is, at least in passing the law, Texas was even more explicit in relying on the common carrier analogy, as if simply labeling websites common carriers makes the First Amendment problems go away. And that is fundamentally wrong for two basic reasons. One, these companies don't operate actually as common carriers. They all have terms of use that exclude varying degrees of content. And second, Texas can't simply convert them into public common carriers by its say-so. I welcome the court's questions.
That was Paul Clement giving the opening argument in Net Choice versus Paxton. Zach, as you know, U.S. law describes a common carrier as a private or public entity that transports goods or people from one place to another for a fee. The term is also used to describe telecommunication services and public utilities. The word common is the noteworthy distinction. Common carriers like buses offer services to the general public, unlike private carriers that may be available only to specific clients on a contractual basis. Utilities are considered common carriers because they make no distinction in who their customers are. It's available to anyone in its coverage area who is willing to pay their fee. I personally think common carriers like phones and utilities function on a substantively different level than social media platforms because they can serve as lifelines for individuals who need to access vital services like ambulances or fire departments. What are your reactions to all of this?
I think that's absolutely right. And they're also different because of the social nature of social media versus a private use of a telecommunication service. So going back to my example from the start of our conversation about school shooting deniers, people who want to call school shootings hoaxes can talk on the phone to each other without harming the ability of parents and student activists to connect with like-minded individuals. Not so on social media posts. Currently, if someone posts on social media about being a survivor or being afraid of a school shooting or wanting to work on gun control, then the algorithm can identify that user as someone who might want to see posts from other survivors, from support organizations, from activist groups like Every Town for Gun Safety or Students Demand Action. But if Texas and Florida are allowed to give those deniers a kind of most favored nation status on social media, then the social media platforms would be compelled to provide and promote the denier posts on users' feeds in the same way they would promote those other posts. So that would cause a lot of disruption for any efforts to reach out and identify new anti-shooting activists, to create supportive communities for survivors. And not just because the posts that those survivors need to see are going to get lost in the din, but also because the platform becomes a hostile environment where survivors aren't going to want to be spending their time. A Pew Research study from back in 2020 found that 41% of Americans have personally experienced some form of online harassment. And there's every reason to believe that that has only gotten worse in the past few years. And that's with moderation being legal. So it's just not the same as providing telecommunication services or other utility access. This is another issue, but I would argue that it makes sense to designate ISPs as common carriers. But there just isn't a match with social media platforms, either in terms of the rationale for why we would call them a common carrier or for the social costs of banning moderation.
I agree with that. Zach, another issue the justices considered is application of Section 230 of the 1996 Communications Decency Act. In a nutshell, Section 230 generally provides immunity for online computer services with respect to third-party content generated by its users. It promotes free speech by removing strong incentives for platforms to limit what we can say and do online. But notably, before Section 230 was enacted, companies cultivating online communities were legally responsible for what their users posted.
And this is where social media corporations and progressive activists are going to part ways, and actually where the companies find themselves in a little bit of a bind. The platforms, the social media corporations, are pushing materials to users in ways that, at least I would argue, should be more carefully regulated and for which they should be held liable when their product design causes harm. But of course, the companies want to claim free speech rights without acknowledging that they're engaged in the kind of speech that might actually fall outside of 230 immunity.
Let's take a listen to a very short exchange on Section 230. This is between Paul Clement and members of the court.
It's speech for purposes of the First Amendment, your speech, your editorial control. But when we get to Section 230, your submission is that that isn't your speech.
Yes, as a matter of statutory construction, because otherwise Section 230 ends up being self-defeating. Because, again, the whole point of Section 230 was to promote that editorial discretion. And this court, you know, this court wrestled with these issues. They're hard issues. And I certainly applaud the instinct that you shouldn't resolve them here. But I don't think just by recognizing that my clients are engaged in editorial discretion when they make those decisions about what's going to ultimately go to the individualized screen that a user's going to see when they tap into their website or their application. I don't think that's the kind of speech that is you're talking about in the 230 context. And if you did, I think you would defeat the fundamental purpose of 230, because they wanted you. They wanted my clients and others to exercise that editorial discretion to keep the bad material
with
out.
With respect to other people's speech. So it seems like we have speech, and then we have speech.
You can't – you literally – and this is – again, I'm happy to argue that case right now if we want to, but you can't have –
Well, no, it's a really hard question for us, and it's perfectly relevant here and very important because, of course, 230 preempts things, and we don't know how much of this law it preempts.
Absolutely. But this law is unconstitutional in all its applications, and certainly in its, it has no plainly legitimate sweep. So you don't have to reach the 230 question directly here. And I would simply say that when you're reading those statutory terms in 230, you wouldn't sweep in editorial discretion, because if you do, you will defeat the fundamental purpose of Section 230, which is to empower editorial discretion.
Well, I just wanted to raise with you the question I raised with the Solicitor General, who offered a thoughtful response. But many of your clients' terms of service, while reserving some editorial discretion, and I think about most of them as speaking about the things covered by 230, obscenity, et cetera, go out of their way to promise an open forum to all members of the public and go out of their way to say we don't endorse what other people say on this site and go out of their way to say all views shall flourish. Now, that's not true for all of your clients, but it's true for some of them, and many of them. What do we do about that?
That was part of an exchange between appellate attorney Paul Clement and several justices from last month's oral arguments in the case Moody v. NetChoice and NetChoice v. Paxton. Zach, in terms of Section 230 liability, we have to mention cases against three tech giants. You'll recall that U.S. citizen Noemi Gonzalez was killed by a terrorist attack in France back in 2015. The next day, ISIS claimed responsibility and released a YouTube video. Gonzalez's father sued Google, Twitter, and Facebook, claiming, among other things, that all three platforms were liable for aiding and abetting international terrorism. He said they failed to take meaningful action to prevent terrorists from using its services. Then in 2023, in Twitter v. Tamna, the Supreme Court unanimously declined to impose secondary liability on tech companies for allegedly failing to prevent ISIS from using their platforms for recruiting, fundraising, and organizing. How do those cases relate to this?
So really importantly, those rulings that you just mentioned, the lawsuits against Twitter and Google as parent company for YouTube, held that the Anti-Terrorism Act, which is the law under which those plaintiffs were suing, does not reach the sort of conduct that that suit alleged. Essentially, the ruling was that providing a platform used by terrorists doesn't constitute aiding and abetting or providing material support. So the court didn't reach the Section 230 immunity issue. It was a big win for social media corporations, but it did not insulate them from all lawsuits alleging harm by the design of their products or the functioning of their algorithms, as long as the claims being brought against them are for violation of laws other than the Anti-Terrorism Act. And there are just such lawsuits going forward right now against social media companies. For example, two major cases brought by states and by parents alleging that social media is designed to maximize screen time in a way that's especially harmful to young people, and that it aggravates body image issues and bullying and other sorts of social problems. So as a larger point, I would say that those sorts of lawsuits are an example of why the Florida and Texas laws are not what we need. The law has ways to require social media companies to do better at protecting against the harm that their platforms can cause. As I said at the start, the Florida and Texas laws are just not aimed at the real damages and harm from social media. But existing product liability and negligence laws and other kinds of doctrines can be directed at social media companies in ways that would not cause the sorts of problems that we've been discussing of requiring them to promote posts from school shooting deniers the same way they do survivor networks. If anyone wants to follow those sorts of lawsuits, the lawsuits by the parents have been consolidated as In Re Social Media Adolescent Addiction / Personal Injury Product Liability Litigation, the long one, and it advances claims based on consumer protection laws, negligence, and fraudulent concealment. And then there's an action by 33 states captioned Arizona versus Meta that brings claims for false advertising and violations of various business regulations and consumer protection laws.
Zach, we're running out of our allotted time. A quick question. If you were on the Supreme Court, how would you rule in these two cases?
Highly hypothetical scenario. But you know, one of the most fundamental premises of free speech is that we keep the government out of the role of censor, and we let the marketplace of ideas work out the best approaches to social issues. There's obviously limits on that, like with negligence and product liability, like I was just discussing. There's also fraud and harassment and any number of other concepts that can be brought to bear. But how do we create this sort of modern salon of online communities without allowing them to be disrupted by bigots and conspiracy theorists is a problem that the people need to be allowed to figure out. And there are strong efforts underway trying to figure out how to do that. The Santa Clara Principle started out as human rights activists, set of ideas from human rights activists and academics about how do we deal with hate speech online, and it's now been endorsed by some of the major players in the space. The issue continues to get attention from activists and scholars, including even the National Academy of Sciences recently. We obviously need more of this, demanding corporate responsibility from the social media companies, and I'm sure we'll get it. But on this law, on these cases, I would just strike down the Florida and Texas laws and let that litigation, social activism, and experimentation unfold and find the better way forward.
Mm. I love that, Zach. And when I'm president, I'm going to nominate you to the High Court. Zach Wolf, Your insights are always appreciated. We look forward to having you back when the High Court comes.